60 Hertz.
Hello and welcome to 60 Hertz, the democracy podcast for the next few months. I'm here with Karen Pettersen.
That's me.
And we will talk about democracy for the next weeks to come with preeminent thinkers from Harvard and MIT.
Yes, and ourselves.
And ourselves. we have questions and we sort of might have some input, weigh in into the discussion. We'll have breakfast most of the time in this very beautiful bunker-like room of the Lippmann House off Kirkland Avenue. And we had the pleasure just to talk with Taylor Scotchpole this morning. What do you think?
Well, just to tell our listeners who she is, she's a professor in sociology, I think, and political science at Harvard. She's this grand old lady of political science, one of them, in the U.S., and she has done a lot of research on money in politics, on institutions, the role of the state. And she, I kind of loved her. I loved talking to her.
I knew that before.
Yeah, so she's not the visionary type, perhaps.
We'll have that next week,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah, so she's very much here now. I think she's interesting because she thinks a lot about how to use existing organizations, existing structures for change. She's not, she says, you have to win elections to...
Still, she seemed torn.
She seems very torn. Yeah, it was an interest. She was going back and forth.
Yeah, so she said that it's not economy, but immigration, and that's the key question that you sort of struggle with.
Yeah, I don't really agree with that, but I agree with a lot of the other things she said.
But it was nice, sort of, that as she said, that she's an American patriot.
Yeah.
Which I can relate to, because she so believes so much in the... Not only the sort of the meaning and the message of this country, but the very sort of the work of the
exactly. And it's interesting to hear someone who is so pessimistic about Donald Trump and who is so like fearful of him, but still be trying to believe in the American people or the counter forces in this political moment. And she was kind of struggling with that, I think. So, but you will have to listen.
Yeah, let's
and make your own judgment.
Let's listen into that. Welcome, Taylor Scotchpole, to the podcast.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Should we start right at the beginning, right where we are?
Okay.
How did we get here? And I think the most pressing questions for any concerned observer, will the institutions hold in this country?
In the United States?
Yeah.
I do think American institutions, if we mean by that, not just governing institutions, political parties, but civil society, the media, will hold during this period. How we got here? Well, I've been studying the U.S. right for some time, and some years ago wrote a book with Vanessa Williamson, who's now at the Brookings Institution, on the Tea Party. Which erupted, as everybody will recall, right at the beginning of Barack Obama's presidency in 2008, when many commentators thought the Democrats were riding a wave of the future with young voters, minority voters, who were a rising proportion of the U.S. population, a lot of educated whites, particularly women. And that Tea Party was two prongs that were kind of going at the Republican Party at the time, which had just lost under John McCain, as well as opposing Democrats and Barack Obama. The top-down components were ultra-free market elites. Above all, as time passed, the growing Koch network around Charles and David Koch, which has created virtually a third political party to the far right, designed to pull the Republican Party in the United States toward anti-government, ultra-free market, anti-environmental and global warming regulations, dismantling social spending of the kind we have in this country, which is mainly focused on the elderly, and certainly opposing Obama's new initiatives to tax the rich slightly more and pay for health care for lower-income people. Also to reform the immigration system in a way that would create a path to citizenship for some 11 million. They were opposed to all of that. Maybe the elite's not so opposed to the path for citizenship, but the bottom-up part of the Tea Party, which was really conservative activists who are angry at their own party as well as for the Democrats. For them, we learned in our interviews and observations the number one issue was fear of immigration, anger about immigration, and about the changing cultural and racial composition of the United States, and Obama symbolized that. Now, you know, all of that played into the Republicans gaining ground during the aftermath of the Great Recession in the 2010 elections, coming closer in 2012, although they didn't win, making ground in the Congress, state legislatures. So they've really made a lot of gains as the party has moved to the far right. But by the time you go into the 2016 cycle, I mean, the Republican Party was in many ways kind of buffeted and hollowed out, and Donald Trump walked right into that gap. He defeated, as we know, 16 much more normal, I mean, in the sense of their careers, normal Republican candidates, most of them more normal, governors, senators. And he tapped into that populist anger at the base of the Republican Party, which I think is much more focused on immigration than it is on economic issues. This is a disagreement among analysts, but I think the anger about immigration is the wellspring here. And he captured the Republican nomination, and once he had that, you know, it's different than in Europe. In Europe, these populist nativist tendencies often go into third, fourth, fifth parties. And they may change the nature of coalitions. They may change, they may move major parties in the parliamentary systems, but they often don't take over outright. Once you have this kind of thrust taking over in the form of a media manipulating, he's a narcissist. He expresses resentment. He's going to govern at home and abroad in an angry style that reflects really a minority of Americans who are the popular base of the Republican Party. But once they take over a major political party, then they have a chance to win, and that's what happened. Squeaked in. Now he's in charge of a unified party government, which is frightening because the United States has very few checks and balances inside government for leaders who violate basic norms.
Still, you say that you think that institutions will hold.
I do, but I think the institutions that are going to hold are going to be the ones outside government. We're already seeing a change in behavior of major media outlets who recognize that they were played for fools in the primaries and general election. And even though the Trump regime is going to try to bypass them and does bypass them in terms of communicating with their core supporters, I don't expect to see the Washington Post, CNN, the New York Times, and there are a variety of now independent news outlets on the internet. None of them are going to cave in the face of even a lot of harassment. And I think that you're going to see organized opposition in civil society in and around the Democratic Party. Now, I have a big question how much the Democratic Party is going to get its act together. I don't think that we know yet. But I don't really think you're going to see many Americans, particularly in the sort of more urban areas and the coastal states, sitting back while extreme actions are taken from Washington. Now, a lot of those are going to happen anyway, and it is an open question whether this is going to be a 4 or 8 year interval and whether there will be losses for the Republicans in Congress. And I don't know the answer to that yet. I don't think anybody does.
I'm interested in what you said about what happened with the Republican Party and sort of the hijacking of the party by these billionaires or by corporate interests. And you've been writing about this and doing a lot of research on the Koch brother network and so on. Would you say that the success of Trump is kind of a... Because they have been driving, as you say, the Republican Party to the right
On economic issues.
Yeah. And they haven't really had the voters with them on that.
They don't have the voters with them on dismantling health insurance in this country or cutting back Social Security or breaking unions or any of those
things. So is Trump's reaction to that kind of to an overreach, would you say?
No, I think he's more taking advantage of a vacuum.
Okay.
You know, Trump ran for office by giving hints that he would combine, this is a combination I think we see more in European politics than we've seen in the United States, that he would combine nativist opposition to immigration with defense of social spending for Native Americans. Now that he's in office, though, I mean, and this was evident like the day after the election, that a lot of that defense of the welfare state here for even for native-born people might very well not be the case, because he's appointed very extreme. The irony of the Koch network is that they don't support Trump. They didn't.
Yeah.
And by they, I mean the brothers themselves and many of their 400 to 500 donors that meet twice a year. Some of them did. You know, rich people in the United States go all over the place when it comes to supporting particular candidates, and there are some Koch attendees who have defected even in the primaries, but they made a big fuss of not supporting him and claiming that they weren't campaigning for him, and rich Americans often didn't donate directly to Donald Trump. First of all, he had a lot of free media, didn't need the money. And secondly, they don't trust him. You know, nobody trusts Trump to not just spend it on his own family businesses. So even those who supported him on the right did so through independent vehicles. But that's the thing about the Koch network. I mean, their major political organization, the Americans for Prosperity, campaigned for Republican senators. They were thinking Trump might lose, so they had Plan B, which is to control everything around Hillary Clinton if she was elected. But they also turned out voters that voted for Trump. And then immediately once he was elected, he turned to politicians that have been very central to the Koch network. Paul Ryan in the House of Representatives, Mike Pence, the vice president, who he was talked into putting on the ticket. He's very closely connected to the Koch network, and they've proceeded to put a lot of their people in charge of domestic policy. Foreign policy is a different matter. Immigration is a different matter. But at home, there are a lot of signs that Trump will sign sweeping cutbacks in American social provision, regulation of business, anti-union measures. Yeah, they're quite happy. And in fact, recently, Tim Phillips, who's the head of Americans for Prosperity, the quasi-political party that the Kochs have created, said, we're happy with most of what he said, that in public. So why wouldn't they be? And they're certainly thrilled with this Supreme Court appointment and hoping for more.
Why is it so difficult to change the obvious deficit of this democratic process that money is the essential role? I mean, you said the nominee for the Supreme Court, when yesterday was announced that there is already $10 million directed towards influencing the Democratic senators who might oppose this nomination. So it feels like, it doesn't feel like a democratic process. It feels like short-term warfare with money as the weapon. And this should be so open for everybody to see that this is distorting.
Well, welcome to American politics. I mean, I'm not of the school of thought that it's sheer amounts of money that are decisive here.
Okay.
I mean, let's look at the situation. Hillary Clinton had plenty of money, and there's going to be a great deal of money deployed through organizations opposing the new Supreme Court appointment. It's not the amount of money, it's how it's spent. And, you know, all I could say is that on the right, the Koch network and others have invested in the right kinds of things. Now, what are those in American politics? Well, I'll tell you what they are. They are federated organizations that can reach into the states. Remember, Hillary Clinton won this election if it were a national election. It wasn't. This is a federated polity in which you have to put together majorities in particular congressional districts and states. And you can eke out a win even without an overall majority if you get organized and contact voters in the right places. That's what the right has been doing. And they've been doing it for a long time. They have pre-existing federated organizations like the National Rifle Association. They have the Christian Right, which really is where a lot of public life occurs in many parts of the United States. Just go visit. You'll see churches are the place where people assemble. And those churches have been cultivated and drawn into political networks over a very long period of time. For them, Christian right people understand that Donald Trump is personally no Christian, but they wanted that Supreme Court appointment. And then you've got the investments of the Koch Network, which really our research shows started in 2004, so that's well before Citizens United. It's not about Citizens United. And they built up this federated organization, which is really kind of right alongside the Republican Party and able to pull it. Americans for Prosperity.
And Citizens United, we should say, is the Supreme Court decision.
A lot of people, on the left think that that decision opened the door to a change in American politics. I disagree with that. I think the big money in politics is not new in the United States. It always finds channels. And there's a lot of money on both sides. The question is how that money is deployed. And it has been deployed in very effective ways on the far right.
So I'm interested in what you're saying, because if you look at the struggle in politics as something between different interests clashing with each other, there used to be in this country, as well as in Europe, more power on the side of labor than now. So we have a situation where trade unions have been weakened, both because of, you know, change in economic structures and as an effect of political decisions. Yeah. And you have this exploding inequality, which gives more money and more capital even to, the corporate interests, who are now...
And very building wealthy these, families, and really,
who are now building these political organizations successfully. Yeah. What's the way out of this?
Well, that's a good question. And, because my analysis, and this is based on research, that I have research groups that do these things, is not simply pointing to the amounts of money given.
Yeah.
I do think that part of the answer has to be organization on the center left and maybe raising a lot of money from modest donors. There are no small donors in American politics. Small donors are people like me. They're professionals who give $100 or even $50 at a time, but do it repeatedly. But, there is an organizational deficit now on the center left, and you pointed to one of the reasons, unions. Now, Europeans need to be aware that American unions have been weaker than European unions for a very long time. That's not new.
Yeah.
They peaked at a third of the labor force in 1955. Mm. So that's not much of a peak, and that's a long time ago. And even compared to Canada, it's much less unionized country. On the other hand, public sector unions in particular were pretty strong in the 1970s, 80s, into the 90s. And they had a real presence in states like Wisconsin in the Midwest, so that you didn't have just California and New York as bastions of liberalism. You could also count on organizations to get out messages, turn out voters, set agendas, influence legislators in both parties.
And really, perhaps form opinion, I guess.
Sure. Yeah. That's in many ways more important than simply what happens at the last minute in an election. And it's not coincidental that these organized right-wing networks, particularly the Koch Network, went after the public sector unions. That was their number one priority. Our research shows that they organized in this American Prosperity Federation. They were in the upper Midwest, in Michigan and Wisconsin, very early, certainly in states like North Carolina as well. And they made it a priority to go after the unions in the sense of passing laws, getting when Republicans got in, 2010, 2011. They passed laws that made it impossible for public sector unions to collect dues and to bargain. Mm. And the effect of that has been to cause their membership to plummet and their political activism to go down. And we have real statistical models that show that even in taking into account partisanship and public opinion, these union things have been furthered by the activities of the organized right. Mm. So that set the stage for this election, and it wasn't setting the stage for Donald Trump. They didn't expect Donald Trump to be the one to come in and take advantage of that, but he did.
So now you say the answer must be some organization. What kind of?
There's going to have to be some kind of, I think it has to be through the Democratic Party itself, which means that the Democratic Party is going to have to reform itself and turn itself into more than just a conduit for checks. Hmm. and just something that runs ads during elections. It's going to have more of an organized presence in a lot of local areas and states, and probably direct groups of volunteers as well as party officials are going to have a, build a presence. I don't see anything outside the party that's likely to do that, because much of the rest of the organized left in the United States takes the form of issue advocacy groups, which are very important, but they don't have a presence necessarily much beyond Washington and New York and maybe California.
But you as an expert of the structure and history of the political body of this country, would you say sort of that it's still working? There's been a lot of discussion about the electoral college, you say, sort of the federal way the this country is organized, which going back historically was always favoring the reactionary South, I guess, or the South to be more objective or not, so for that matter. But also the two-party system, which you say is of this is in a way very much distorting the diversity of the voters.
There are a lot of procedural reformers in the United States who want to pick some procedural thing, the Electoral College, the way presidents are, any of these things, money in politics, and hope that those can be changed. Well, I don't know how they're going to be changed. I'm going to tell you right now they're not going to be changed, because the people who would have to benefit from them have to vote to get rid of them. The Electoral College has been at the center of the organization of the United States since it was born as a nation. And it's not really just the Electoral College. It's that you giving a lot of clout to states, big and small. And that was originally partly a compromise between the free North and the slave South, but it was also a compromise between big states and little states. So you're going to get Delaware and Rhode Island and, all these places to get rid of that? I don't think so, because it gives them more say in, say, the Congress and...
But this is such an interesting question. So, you say change, and in a way, from what I
you got to play within the rules of the game as they exist.
Yeah, but how can you change existing systems? That's the same question in Europe. So, how do you adapt?
Win elections.
You win elections.
Yeah, that's how you do it. You go out and you talk to voters in various places, and you get people registered to vote, and you get them to the polls, and you win elections.
But
I know
the systems are
really
yeah.
simple. but there are an lot of people on the American left who think, street demonstrations, lawsuits.
But don't you have
none
an idea?
Of this. You but win elections.
Yeah, sure. But after you, don't you have to have an idea of, how do you want to use? If you, I agree with you on that. But
I don't.
The purpose of politics is not. I mean, the winning an election is the means, not the purpose. I mean, it's. You win,
pretty important right now.
No.
I mean, if the Democrats don't start winning some elections pretty soon, this thing is going
to
lock
but
in.
But just to support George in his in his question, after you win elections, how would you want to change these institutions so they are stronger and so that corporate interests cannot hijack them?
In retrospect, during the moment when Barack Obama and the Democrats controlled three branches in Washington, they should have done more. On the kinds of things that the right always does in the U.S. The right always goes after the organizational capacities of their opponents and seeks to build up their own organizational capacities. So, they should have done, they probably should have gotten rid of the filibuster, which they could have done, and pushed through some things that now...
Can you explain to our audience why that is important?
Because if you've got to get 60 votes in the Senate, it's very hard to get anything that changes the status quo through. And that was the drama in the first 2 years of Obama's presidency, was whether you could get anything through. They had 59 votes or 58, depending on how you wanted to count Joe Lieberman of Connecticut. And the Republicans tied up Al Franken in challenges for 6 months, not because they thought they were going to win in the end, but because they could keep him from voting. Mm. And then the state of Massachusetts proceeded to elect Scott Brown and take him down to 59 again. And, the whole potential for putting through changes that those sweeping majorities in 2008 wanted was hobbled by that. Now, I know why they didn't do it. They would have had trouble getting the support of some of the Democrats. The Democrats are a more diverse political coalition, not just ethnically, but also in terms of centrists, well, not exactly centrists, but moderate liberals and very liberal people from different parts of the country who see politics differently. They aren't as unified as Republicans are.
Could I?
Or haven't been. They may be going forward because threat is a powerful mobilizer, and threat is what's happening now.
I'm sorry to insist, but sort of, anyway, you said something at the beginning which was more, in a way, complex to change than what you say about winning elections. I'd like to sort of just get your grasp of what democracy is about in your mind, because you said there has to be change on the outside. There has to be change in how people interact, how people organize, how people talk about what they want and all that. And that seems to drive change more than election, or that might lead
to winning elections. Well, it's not either or, it's both.
But maybe you can sort of sketch out your, because I think, in a way, how people talk about politics, especially in the media, especially in TV media, it's so super reductionist that it's furthering sort of misunderstanding of what politics is. So I think there has to be reconstruction of the way that people conceive of themselves as political animals, to use a antique term, but sort of to conceive of themselves as citizens. And I'm interested
to some degree there is. That's going on. I mean, I think especially younger Americans are not doing things the old way. And we're seeing a fair amount of I would say lateral organization and people organizing in their local areas and wanting to connect to others. Now the big question in the American center left is always, will that be done in a way that treats the Democratic Party as something you should attack and dismantle, or are you going to leverage it and reform it and use it? Certainly the right did just that. The Tea Partiers never tried to dismantle. They took advantage of and tried to change and use the Republican Party. Occupy Wall Street did not, and Occupy Wall Street, flitted and disappeared. The big question now is whether these huge marches that we've seen, I don't really mean the ones about immigration, I mean the Women's March, which was huge and was all over the country. It wasn't just in the capital or just in the big cities. It was substantial numbers of people in small cities and in states across the country. Will those people then begin to organize and organize outside the cities in their states? You don't really need a majority. You need a concerted small group of people who are prepared to speak up, who are prepared to offer interpretations. The Trump environment is going to be very rich for this because the man has promised things he is not going to deliver on, or he's going to deliver on disasters. I'm willing to make that kind of prediction. My sister lives in West Virginia. The people there are all convinced that Donald Trump is bringing back high-paying coal jobs. Well, not only is he not going to bring back high-paying coal jobs, which have been killed by deunionization, technological change, and natural gas, he's going to make life tougher there because anything he does to create a trade war is going to raise the prices at Walmart, where these very poor people go for their white people, not black people. And furthermore, there are no immigrants there to speak of, and these people are also going to be facing new privations once they cut back on the health insurance programs. So what Democrats and citizens groups who are opposed to Trump, who are not all Democrats, need to do is identify some of these issues that are very core to communities of various types. Healthcare cutbacks are a big one. And talk about those. Make visible what's happening or could happen. And get people registered to vote and to turn out. If in 2017 and 18 the Republicans lose some governorships, if they lose ground in the Congress, that will be a shot across the bow for the rest of the Republicans, and they will begin to think, maybe we should do more than look over our shoulder to the right or worry about the latest tweet from Donald Trump. If that doesn't happen, though, Trump could easily cement himself in, especially if the economy yeah, as well.
That's the big story. I think that's so interesting, also comparing this moment in time with other moments in time when you've had strong leaders emerge. I mean, the big difference here, you do have this exploding inequality, but at the same time, you have this a strong economy. You have, you know, growth coming back, jobs coming back. So it's a great moment for Trump in that sense. It's a big advantage for him.
Well, it depends on what he's doing. I mean, I do. The thing is, American presidents have less control over the economy than everybody imagines. So partly this is a question of developments we can't predict. But I'm having a hard time understanding why even the things he's talking about.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Doing, if he can get them done, are going to help the economy and social fabric of the places that elected him. I'm with some professors here, we've launched a new research project. We're going to track what happens in two Trump counties apiece in Pennsylvania, Ohio, Wisconsin, and North Carolina. So it's an open question, but if there are cutbacks in health insurance, that hits these places even harder than it does lower-income urban populations, because the healthcare, older white places have a lot of people who depend on federal subsidies of various kinds for their health insurance. Their hospitals may close if those subsidies are cut back. I don't know that Trump gets that. I don't know that he understands that his Republican allies in Congress want to make changes that are going to go right at his supporters. Mm. The coal jobs and the factory jobs are not coming back. Even an infrastructure bill, which he may get through Congress, or building the wall along the southern border. How is that going to build the economy in these depressed areas of Pennsylvania and Ohio and Michigan and Wisconsin? It's not, because the infrastructure bill that's being talked about is a bunch of tax cuts. The one thing you can be sure is going to pass, and soon, is big tax cuts for the wealthiest Americans. They don't live in those places. They don't invest in those places.
But then the question is, I guess, whether people actually expect things to change that much. You know, what are the real expectations of the voters in terms of bringing jobs back? I mean, it could
be a good question.
It could be the fact, I mean, it could be that people think that he's on their side, but they also know that it's not that easy to bring back jobs. Mm-hmm. So and people aren't, I don't know, people are more rational, I think, in terms of how much they think politics can actually affect unemployment and jobs in the short term.
So I think there are very high expectations among some of his core supporters. Now, you know, those expectations also center on him taking strong actions to exclude immigrants, which are largely symbolic for these folks, because the immigrants aren't where they are in most cases, although they are more places than you might think. I just don't know. That's why we're doing this research. We're interested in what people perceive, not just citizens, but also local leaders of key institutions and how they interpret it. I do think it's a mistake to overestimate the voter support for Donald Trump. I mean, he squeaked in, and he squeaked in with a minority of voters. You could argue that all kinds of things, the Comey letter, the crazy lefties who voted for somebody else, I mean, of which there were plenty. And these things made the difference. And a lot of the voters who voted for Trump told surveyors that they thought he wasn't really temperamentally qualified for the presidency. He's lost popularity since he was, which is a real trick. I mean, presidents don't usually lose popularity between the election and the inauguration or in the week after the inauguration. So that signals that there are quite a few soft supporters who were voting against Hillary Clinton or who weren't voting and who have their doubts. Well, those doubts may very well be stoked. And for different groups of voters, it's going to be different things.
Can I go back to something you said earlier, and you talked about, we talked about institutions and that you still trust that they will hold, and you said that the media now plays an important role, and you mentioned how they had been, you said the media had been manipulated during the election campaign. Can you talk a little bit about that and how you think about that? Because we're journalists.
He's a very, very savvy politician, Donald Trump. He understood from early on that if he just said one outrageous thing after another, he'd have the cameras on him all the time. And, you know, a lot of people criticize Hillary Clinton for not having the right message. Well, no message that she tried to convey ever got across, except during the debates when her popularity went up. He just manipulated, particularly the television outlets, to just follow his every move.
So what should journalists have done? What did they do?
Well, the New York Times should be ashamed of itself, I mean, in my view. I mean, it one puff piece on anxieties in the Democratic Party or worries about Clinton emails after another, while a con man, basically, got very little sustained coverage for his most outrageous moves. And, you know, there were a convergent series of things. I think that Washington Post conducted itself pretty well. I don't believe that. But they were, of course, excluded by Trump early on. I mean, one of the interesting dynamics in the American press is that there's a tendency to hang on the every word that a president or a presidential candidate says, and that gives those candidates enormous power to, if they're prepared to be provocative. I think there's been reflection in media circles. I mean, you would know better than I, but I think since the election...
A lot of reflection, I would say.
Yeah.
Reflection, but no clues, really.
No. The Times, the New York Times, you can see that they've changed. I mean, they seem to have more muscle in what they're doing. And I'm not saying that they're only publishing criticisms of Trump, but they are not being led by the nose as much. And they're clearly investigating things and publishing those reports one after another. You're seeing some firmness, I would say.
I'm interested in that point, sort of, that you sort of say that the media was played, which sort of counters a 20th century argument that you say the media is creating the environment for sort of people to understand the context. And so this might signal actually a rupture in the way things are done, or it might just signal that there's a very talented demagogue among us. But I'm interested in all these, how you see all these narratives that seem, from an outside perspective, looking into America, seem so facile in a way. So you have this, or also in European context, you have this narrative, it's against the elites, it's an uprising against the establishment. I think that's sort of, for this country, wrong. For this election, is wrong. It's simplistic, and there's a, sort of it's combined with this very broad narrative of populism, which I think is also not very specific, not very a good narrative, and combined that with the post-election coming to terms with what happened is about the economy. Oh, we forgot the white middle class, which is also not true. And you say that it's not about the economy. So for one, I think this country is under estimating racism in the election. So if that goes to immigration, that would be a question. But the broader question is, how do you see these narratives? How are they constructed, or specifically populism and the white middle class? Are those sort of narratives that
well, the idea that this was about the white working class is not just a media narrative. It's being pushed by the left as well.
But would you agree that because a lot of people that I
think
talk
it's,
are offended by that, because it was
large,
never about the black middle class in the last 30 years either.
Most of the working class in the United States is no longer white, so that right
okay.
there. But come on, Bernie Sanders pushed this. He's still pushing it.
So he shouldn't have.
No, he shouldn't have. He bears some responsibility in all of this. I did spend some time looking closely at exactly what happened in the election, not because I think that's the main thing to be doing now, but I had promised to give a lecture a week after the election called Understanding Election 2016, so I had to. And I had been working on it all along. To me, the thing that really changed from earlier Republican versus Democratic presidential elections was that Trump piled up high margins in non-big city counties. Now, what that means is that it wasn't really a class thing. It was a community thing. Instead of losing, say, non-big city counties in Pennsylvania 60-40 the way Obama usually did, because it's not new for white middle-income people to go Republican. That's been happening for quite some time. Instead of losing by that margin, Hillary Clinton lost some of those counties 70-30, 80-20. What that means is that entire communities came to see themselves either in Donald Trump's message or in opposition to whatever they thought Hillary Clinton was standing for, and probably Barack Obama before that. Now, have those communities as communities suffered economically? Yes, they have. And they are also the site of increasing social disintegration. The drug problem is very bad in those areas. You just need to drive, which I do all the time. I drive beyond the liberal enclaves in which I live now. And you can see it. And that he tapped into that resentment. And it is partially racial. There's no question about it. But it's not only racial. And even the parts of it that are racial, I think, need to be understood. It's not so much that most people living in those areas, there you can find some, you know, almost neo-Nazi-like young men, but most people are not like that, and they are not necessarily rejecting of individual people. The immigrants that live in their midst, the Latinos they know, the occasional black person that they might know. It's that they perceive government, and I think this perception grew under Obama, as distributing largesse on city people, heavily minority, and neglecting them. Now, of course, that's unfair. Obama actually did preside over some laws that have made things better for people in those communities, which they're suddenly realizing as Obamacare might be repealed. I mean, they didn't. A lot of Americans didn't know what was in Obamacare. Well, they're suddenly realizing that more, as political scientists would predict this. When something is about to be taken away, people notice it more than they did before, and you've seen a real shift in even Republican opinion on that. Maybe too late. A lot of those people were not really voting for the specific policy changes they're getting. Americans often don't vote for policy changes. They vote for people, and they vote for an attitude. And I do think that the non-metropolitan communities are often angry as hell. They feel they've been left behind. And that's not entirely wrong. I mean, they have been in some ways. It's not so much a matter of closing factories or trade or any one thing. It's just a general...
So why don't you think that Bernie Sanders should have pushed that narrative that George is speaking about?
He went on way too long about how Hillary Clinton was corrupt. The whole thing just looks ridiculous in reverse. I mean, it just looks ridiculous. A problem with some emails and a couple of speeches on Wall Street compared to what's happening now? I
mean, so you mean that specifically, the attacks on Clinton, rather than
Or the claim that the Democratic Party was corrupt. And, he said he was speaking for the working class, but he didn't mostly get working class votes.
Right.
First of all, most working class people are not white, which you wouldn't know from listening to the debate. But even in states where in a few states where he had overwhelming margins, he had white less educated white people voted for him. But in some of those states, they were voting for him as a proxy for voting for Trump. I mean, let's go into West Virginia, which I happen to know very well because my sister lives there, and they interviewed a lot of the people who voted for Trump versus Clinton in the primary, and they said they weren't voting for anybody who'd work for that nigger, Hillary Clinton, race. And they were planning to vote for Trump in the general, which they did. And we know that if you go into neighboring Kentucky, where people in similar kinds of downscale communities where coal mining has gone long since and they're living in poverty, they can vote for none of the above. Well, they did vote for none of the above. And so Hillary Clinton carried Kentucky, barely. in the primary. So this tells you that, I'll tell you who voted for Bernie Sanders. Young college people. His contributors and his voters were overwhelming in college communities and in liberal, the most liberal parts.
Which is the generation sort of that was, I guess, most affected by the central historical event that led to this election result in this country, but also, I think, sort of upended a lot of balances in Europe. And I would sort of like to sort of talk about that and shift the view to
and
democracy.
And they all took for granted that Hillary Clinton was going to win.
Yeah, but
she
was...
They all took for granted, and a lot of them didn't vote.
So there was a financial crisis.
I don't agree that college students are the most affected by the...
Okay, but let me try to make the point.
Not
but
true.
Okay, maybe they weren't the most affected, but so if I as far as I can tell, this was a rebellion, a revolt against what happened during the financial crisis. That's Steve Bannon's view of capitalism, of the world. This is crony capitalism. This is not enlightened capitalism, as he sort of says that. And the irony for somebody like me is that sort of people of the left have always made the point that the way the financial crisis was handled was all wrong, especially sort of in Europe, driving whole countries into bankruptcy or semi-suicide. 50% youth unemployment in Spain and all that, and sort of, which is strangely holding Spain, and that created, for example, in Germany, this combined with the immigrant influx, this very toxic situation. How on a, and you say, well, it's
the United States is not Germany.
And it handled
the financial crisis much better than Germany did. Much better than Europe did.
I agree with that.
Okay. But still, it was a revolt against what happened for a lot of people who see that they were sort of...
I don't agree with that.
You don't agree with that?
No, I don't. I mean, I don't think so. I don't think that that's... Now,
but this is the Bannon
first
argument.
First of all, that's the Bannon argument, but it's not my argument. So it's fine for that to be the Bannon argument. It converges with some people on the left, but I don't agree with that analysis. I don't think that's what fueled the Bernie challenge to Hillary Clinton. First of all, there's nothing unusual about a left challenge to a mainstream Democrat in American primaries. They happen all the time. There's only one that's ever won the nomination, and that's Barack Obama, and he won it because he had black people supporting him. Bernie Sanders had basically no support from Latinos and blacks in the primary. He wouldn't have had it in the general election either, to the degree that he needed it. You know, you have to ask yourself, if you're an American at least, on the left, you have to ask yourself, what does that mean? That's the majority of the working class in this country. We can wax on and on as if it was the 1930s, but it's really not.
So that's why people thought that the Republican Party is actually a step ahead, that they had two Latino candidates who might have tapped into that electorate.
Well, I don't think they would have. They're Cubans.
But that's, you would say that's, you have to
say. In the United States, we know our ethnicities. And Cubans are not typical of Latinos.
But that's interesting. So going forward, so if you would say that there has to be a reconfiguration of alliances that form.
Democrats just need to have a little bit more presence beyond their base. They don't need to give up their base. They shouldn't do that. They should continue to work to get young people, minorities involved, and they should certainly speak for the various things that they're speaking for. But they need more of a presence outside of non-metropolitan communities. That means they need to organize in those places, and they haven't been doing it.
But don't you think...
Barack Obama did more of it, by the way.
I guess going also back to the question of what is this a reaction? If we see this as a reaction, what do we see it as a reaction against? And I agree with the fact that the U.S. handled the financial crisis so much better than Europe. I think that's undisputed almost. But at the same time, at another level, we have this exploding inequality. And that is, I mean, that's the deeper trend. That's
we
the
do.
Bigger trend.
Yeah.
And coming as us, you know, coming from the progressive side of politics or from the left, that, I mean, the bigger, much bigger question is, what do you do about that? Because it's one thing to handle a financial crisis and you know, stimulus packages and some tax cuts and some and they did that well. But what do you do about these bigger things? And isn't Trump, in a way, channeling the discontent of change that comes with inequality, that comes with globalization? You said that you don't believe the economic models for explaining this.
Not primarily.
But what is the connection then between? Is it only, you said immigration?
Immigration.
So why are people so worried about immigration? Doesn't that have to do with these other changes as well?
A little bit. I mean, all I can say is that when we interviewed Tea Party people at the grassroots in 2011, by the way, that's when Donald Trump first announced his birther critique.
Right.
Caught a lot of attention. If he'd run then, I think he would have been the non-Romney that many of them wanted. And they did want a non-Romney. We were talking to conservative activists at the grassroots, and you know, everywhere we talked to them, immigration was what made them angry, and it wasn't an economic thing in the sense of jobs. It was about, people would say, oh, they're crowding into the hospital emergency rooms. They're forcing me to select English or Spanish on the phone. Their kids are in the schools. If you go out into non-metropolitan America and you look, what you'll see is that in a lot of places, no doubt because of these crazy policies that have been followed by both parties for quite some time, industries and unions have collapsed. You have low-paying jobs only, or backbreaking jobs, and immigrant communities have come into these places all over the country.
Yeah, but then there's the question of jobs.
Sufficient numbers to make them wonderful political fodder, but not insufficient numbers to change the votes in a lot of these states. So jobs are part of it, but they are not the proximate cause. The proximate cause is a reaction against Obama as a black president. And, you know, the most egalitarian policy to pass the United States federal government in the last 50 years is the Affordable Care Act.
I'm interested.
It taxes the rich, and it pays for insurance for white and black and brown people who don't have health insurance.
So I think looking at it from a global perspective, it's interesting to hear what you say, because you would could argue sort of in an apocalyptic left perspective, oh, it's all going down the drain. It's all part of the same movement towards a liberal democracy or towards reactionary governments, and this is all connected. And you say this is not specifically connected.
Well, I do think you have to. You do have to look at Europe and various countries where these right populist movements are happening, and the United States. You have to look country by country to get a sense of what tensions are being exploited. Now, will there be connections? Yeah, I think there probably is. I mean, I think Trump's ascendancy in the United States, even though, remember, it's a minority ascendancy, it's a squeaking through in an oddly structured political system, that is emboldening really racial nationalists in Europe and elsewhere. And that could dismantle much of the Western, post-World War II Western order. It certainly could. We haven't talked about the foreign policy side of this, and I think that's much more threatening. I think if you're looking at domestic policy, the particular forces feeding it are not the same in all these countries. And certainly the interaction of anti-immigrant sentiment with an anti-refugee sentiment with feelings about the welfare state are quite different. Partly because the welfare states are very different in these countries.
Yeah, that's why this explanation is surprising to me, because I think it's more intuitively, feels more intuitively correct in Europe to talk, where we do have an immigration shock in the last years. But in the U.S., what you've had is actually immigration going down. And at the same time, this, as you say, explosion of anti-immigrant sentiment that is partly
well, remember, the United States has
so is it more, I'm just thinking, is it more about Obama and racism connected to Obama more than, you know, actual immigration?
Well, I think it's both coming together. And, you know, the United States, you're right. I mean, Europe, you can point to an actual refugee crisis. It really is real and quite alarming. And the terrorist incidents have been horrendous. And we've had some in the United States as well. Terrorism is another part of this that we're not talking about. And the U.S. incidents have not really been due to immigration. They've been due to what always happens in the United States, which is some young man going off the rails all by himself, or maybe with a brother or something, and using good old American ingenuity to get the weapons and or make them and go out and ravage some people. That happens pretty regularly in the United States, quite apart from Islam or anything else. But it does provide fodder, and it has provided fodder, fear of that. But I think you're right. I think that when we talk about the tensions that Obama has been able to play, they are both longstanding black-white racial tensions and the racial tensions that an era of high immigration, even if it's tailed off recently, have given rise to. Immigrants have spread all over the United States, but not in sufficient numbers in a lot of places to change the politics in a liberal direction. Instead, you know, they do in California, but in a lot of places they can be scapegoated. Well, this guy is scapegoating them. I mean, he launched his presidential campaign by saying it's rapists coming across the Mexican border. That's not true, but that's what he said. And that definitely does pick up on some of the racial anxieties that a lot of native-born, middle-income whites in particular feel. The end of a presidency, two terms of the presidency of a black president. So the black president is a really big part of this. And the fact that Hillary Clinton tried to build on that coalition by, say, embracing the Black Lives Matter movement, she needed to do that. It was the right thing to do morally and policy-wise, and it was also important to mobilizing the Barack Obama constituency. But the degree to which that angered white police forces across the country cannot be underestimated as a factor in this. Their anger and their fear, and it is fear as well, contributed to the mobilization. All the security forces, all the security unions were behind Trump. And they have a presence in a lot of communities in the United States. It's probably a bigger factor than it would be in Europe.
I agree. Should we sort of talk about foreign policy for the last bit of, or
sure,
for a few minutes? In Europe, sort of, it was said that this is the end of the American century, per se. Basically, so if isolationism setting in, and so is America, is the U.S. able to sort of single-handedly tear apart the whole system of worldwide corporations,
corporations,
United Nations? So is that what we see? Is that sort of what we'll see in the next 40, 50, or 30 years? A disintegration of all the ways that foreign policy and cooperation has been handled?
Well, let's just deal with the next 4 years. I mean, it's already evident that Donald Trump is going to alienate everybody. This is a one-man wrecking crew. I mean, everybody who deals with him, and that's in his business empire, in the politics. Think about his supporters even in the Republican Party. They're all burned in the end. He's going to burn our allies, which will weaken the Western alliances.
Yelled at the... Clear at the Australian, or he hung up on the Australian Prime Minister.
He threatened to invade Mexico. I mean, he's humiliating the Mexican president, which means, and the problem, I mean, I actually thought the Wall Street Journal laid it out pretty well. I mean, they're not a liberal organ. They said Trump is going to have to learn, and I doubt that he will, that dealing with foreign heads of state is not the same thing as the business partners and politicians he humiliates here, or even the corporations that he humiliates here. Because there are publics in these countries, and when the publics hear that their leader has been humiliated by a loathsome, in their view, American president, they're going to pressure those heads of state to stand up, or they'll vote him out of office. And that's going to weaken the ability of Western countries to cooperate. I mean, I think Europe would be smart. Most European countries would be smart to just realize that they need to treat Donald Trump with kid gloves and start working with each other. I mean, that's the thing that interests me, whether his intimidation tactics will cause disintegration of ties or whether they will encourage other countries as well as other people in the United States who don't support him to form ties with each other and just firmly, quietly, and persistently stand up. I think that may happen in the United States, which is why I have quite a bit of faith in American civil society. I don't think it's that easy to tell Americans to kowtow. It just isn't. It's one of our strengths that we don't do that. And whether we can organize to not kowtow is another question. But will other countries, including supposed American allies, respond to all of this by strengthening their ties with each other and working bypasses around the United States? To me, that's the optimistic path. Now, that's not good for America. I mean, I'm an American patriot, and I think this country will be so much weaker after even 4 years of this.
What's the pessimistic path?
Wars and spreading nativism and fear.
I was going to end on the optimistic path.
On that note.
No, I hope not.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, if a war with Iran is not going to do anybody any good, but there are people around Donald Trump who want just exactly that.
That's how it seems.
Yeah.
Just reading the news.
Very, very, very quick.
Okay. All right.
Okay.
Thank you so much for this conversation.